This is Morning Edition on Vermont Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Language can be a tricky thing to define. In one sense, you think of your own native tongue, whether that's English, Spanish, or any of the other myriad dialects crisscrossing the globe. But how you choose to use that language, if you'll pardon the pun, speaks volumes. The guest I have now in our VPR studios wants you to know that one mode of language that is too often neglected, and for all the wrong reasons, is poetry. And he should know, because Char Dunord is Vermont's poet laureate, appointed to that post last year. Char Dunord lives in Westminster West. He's a co-founder of the New England College MFA program in poetry. He teaches English and creative writing at Providence College and is the author of numerous collections of poetry, including Night Mowing, Sharp Golden Thorn, and The Double Truth. He's also published a collection of interviews with American poets called Sad Friends, Drowned Lovers, Stapled Songs, and his latest book of poetry is called Interstate. Char Dunord, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mitch. Great to be here.
Last year, you replaced Vermont's previous poet laureate, Sidney Lee, upon his retirement. I want to know how it felt when you learned that you would be succeeding him.
Shocked. I had no idea. The Vermont Council of the Arts meets for 3 or 4 months, winnowing down names, and somehow ended up with mine. And I thought it was a joke, frankly, at first. I mean, there's so many wonderful poets in Vermont, and so I didn't expect this appointment at all.
People might wonder what that title poet laureate really means. Are you a kind of ambassador for poetry in this state? I mean, how would you describe it?
That's exactly it. And to celebrate as many of Vermont's poets as I can, while also at the same time being in conversation with other poets throughout the country. So as Robert Frost, who was the first poet laureate of Vermont, said, he liked to keep one foot in Vermont and the other in the nation. So Vermont's legacy, poetic legacy, is extraordinary with such poet laureates as Robert Frost and Galway Connell and Louise Glick and Ellen Bryant Voigt and Grace Paley and Ruth Stone and Sid Lee. So I feel an enormous, not so much burden, but responsibility to carry on that tradition.
You know, for a lot of us, even folks like me who were English majors once upon a time, poetry can come across as a bit intimidating, less straightforward perhaps than, let's say, a novel or a short story. What do you think is the biggest misconception about poetry and its accessibility?
That's a great question. I just wrote an article, in fact, for the Valley News on this subject called America's Love-Hate Relationship with Poetry. You know, and while on the one hand, there are these poetry programs all over the country, MFA programs, there's this weird divide that's always existed in this country between those who read poetry and those who simply don't. I think the last NEA statistic was 6% of America's reading public read literary novels and poetry. And yet it's essential language. You know, Walt Whitman said back in 1860s or 50s that a country absorbs its poets as affectionately as he or she absorbs his or her country. And maybe, you know, poets haven't absorbed their country. And of course, Whitman was a genius at it. But Frost perhaps was the next poet that the country embraced to almost the same extent. But I think, you're right, that a lot of people feel that poetry is just too difficult to get.
I remember interviewing Billy Collins once, and the big thing he was trying to point out was stop trying to figure poetry out. Poetry is not a math problem. There isn't any one right answer. I'm paraphrasing there, but that's essentially what he was saying.
That was exactly the point I tried to make in my article. You know, people hear a simple poem like, say, William Carlos Williams' poem, "So Much Depends on a Red Wheelbarrow Beside the White Chickens Glazed with Rainwater." And even though most people love that poem, well, they have no idea what it's about. What exactly depends on a red wheelbarrow? Well, you know, it's the power of that image. Would it help to know that William Carlos Williams, who was a doctor, was looking out the window of a second-story tenement in New Jersey, attending to a boy who was dying of TB, and he reached over and grabbed his prescription pad and wrote that poem down? Williams didn't think it was important for the reader to know that. He just felt that that image was so important.
What do you think are some ways you could get young people to try poetry, to not be too scared of it? I wonder if spoken word poetry may be a way to...
Well, spoken word has been great in many ways. The one complaint I have about academic poets, literary poets, is reciting their poetry. Performance poets, slam poets do a great job at reciting and moving people in huge venues around the country. But this has been a tradition in Europe and particularly in Russia for centuries. If you can't recite your own poetry in Russia, they boo you off the stage. That doesn't happen here. Everybody, and I'm pretty guilty of this myself. I can recite other people's poetry, but I don't recite much of my own. I'm working on that.
You realize you've given me the perfect segue here to say, I would like you to recite one of your poems now.
Well, I was at the state legislature a few months ago reading some poetry from my most recent manuscript, and I read this one, The Way to Sugar. Hang buckets instead of lines, heat the pan with wood instead of gas, stoke the fire every 15 minutes, watch until the sap thickens on the spoon, pour it through a shirt to filter the dirt that's fallen through the steam into the arch, taste the syrup while it's still hot, pour it into bottles as much as you've got. Which is a very unusual poem for me. But after I read this, a woman from the legislature just came up and sat beside me and said, we own this huge sugar house, and I would like a copy of that poem. So yeah, I'm learning a lot from my audience here in Vermont as far as what's connecting and what isn't.
And it does lead me to another question, which is about a sense of place in your work. I'm wondering how much Vermont does influence what you write, or if you're more of the type of writer who just needs a room, a pen, a typewriter, kids ask your parents what that is, or a computer to produce your work.
Vermont has influenced me hugely, but at the same time, I realize I have to be very careful about not repeating what other great Vermont poets have already written, and far better than I could, including Frost, of course, and Galway Kinnell, and Ruth Stone, and Louise Gluck, and Ellen Bryan Voigt. All have written beautifully about, and Sid Lee, about Vermont. And so my challenge is to write what I can. That sounds simple, but it's also, for a poet, profoundly true. You can't write what you can't. I live in the woods on a dirt road off the dirt road, and I see bears, and I see moose. We had a pet grouse who actually befriended us for years. I wrote a lot about him. His name was Randy, and about my neighbors. And so this is a lot of my subject matter, not entirely, but Vermont is a magical place for poets. You never know what's over the next hill or mountain, and it's an extraordinary tradition of just tough people carving existence out of the land here. And that's really a wonderful metaphor for writing poetry. So, I've torn up dozens and dozens of poems because, after finishing them, I realized, well, Frost wrote about that much better. But I've forged ahead believing in my own unconscious. I write out of my unconscious almost entirely.
When you say you write from your unconscious, what do you mean by that?
Well, one of the problems with writing is for poets and perhaps fiction writers as well is being too conscious of what you're writing about, which creates immediate blinders. You really need to be in touch with your dream mind. Bob Dylan's a genius at this. In a stanza, like the last stanza, for instance, in Love Minus Zero, where he writes, the bridge at midnight trembles, the country doctor rambles, bankers' nieces seek perfection, expecting all the gifts that wise men bring. The wind howls like a hammer, the night blows cold and rainy. My love, she's like some raven at my window with a broken wing. So, where did that come? It's all leaping poetry, but it makes beautiful romantic sense.
I haven't read all your poetry, but from what I have read, it doesn't seem that you draw much from, let's say, current events. Thinking about things like the terrible recent events in Orlando,
yes,
this divisiveness we see throughout the country now in this presidential election year. Is your poetry ever political? Is it reflective of the modern world, or is it always more personal and unconscious, as you say?
No. I try to balance the two. I did just write something about this recently, which I called The Transmigration of Grief into Particular Things, New York, San Bernardino, Boston, Paris, Brussels, Orlando. So this is sort of written from the point of view of the victims. I could just read the first stanza. In the anteroom of heaven, they rose in the minds of their survivors, like music to the cloud of unknowing, There was also a room with singing doors, where as angels they appeared to those who shot them like so many pigeons. If only you'd known, they sang in the sweetest voices, that we'd be the ones assigned to meet you here, with a password reminder for entering heaven. You may have refrained from pulling your triggers and spared our lives, the same as yours. So here's the question. How do you spell the name of God with heaven's letters?
Chart Denord is Vermont's poet laureate. His latest work is called Interstate. I want to thank you so much for coming in to speak with us.
Well, thank you very much, Mitch. It's been a great pleasure.